Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It is Tech Tuesday. One of the most prolific ransomware networks in the world got a taste of its own medicine recently when the FBI successfully hacked the hackers. The agency quietly gained access to the group's internal systems over the summer and disrupted its activities, saving potential victims, including hospitals and school districts, $130 million in ransom payments. We're talking about ransomware here on All Sides. Frank Bayak covers cybersecurity for the Associated Press. Before that, he served as the AP's first tech editor. Frank, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Hi, Mike.
Before we get into this, let's just start with a primer. What is ransomware and how does it work?
So let's go back and do a little history on ransomware. Now, the criminals who have been operating online for, you know, more than a decade, pretty much two decades, they started out with other schemes for stealing money, but they developed ransomware essentially to lock up systems and in order to unfreeze and decrypt those systems, they would demand money. Now, ransomware really started, you know, hitting its stride in the late teens. And you'll remember the Colonial Pipeline, which carries most of the petroleum products in the East Coast, was basically frozen for nearly a week because of a ransomware incident. But the thing about a ransomware is that it's really evolved from something different than just freezing up the data to an extortion scheme. And people call it now encryption-based data extortion, where the criminals will sneak into the system and then sew this software that will freeze up the system. But before they actually activate it, they will exfiltrate a lot of data. And that data can be very sensitive. It can be used in identity theft. And this is what victims are most worried about. This was such a big issue in 2021 that President Biden brought it up with Putin at the Geneva summit. The Kremlin, most of these criminals are Russian speakers, and they operate basically out of the reach of U.S. law enforcement. And so this is why at the end of 2021, Nakasone, the NSA director, who also commands the U.S. military cyber command, said, well, you know, we're taking the gloves off. We can't just rely on traditional law enforcement and indict a bunch of criminals who probably will never see the inside of a U.S. courtroom. Yeah. So what they did is they went on the offensive, and they don't really explain to us what it is that they do, but they have interrupted in the past some of these ransomware syndicates. But the problem with all of this is that because these criminals are out of reach, what you do may not have any long-term impact on the phenomenon.
How do these ransomware attackers, how do they choose their targets? You mentioned the Colonial Pipeline. They've also looked at the British Postal Service, the government of Costa Rica.
There are, you know, what you have to do is you have to look at these guys now as organized businesses. They will go for high-profile targets, or they will go for targets of opportunity. They basically are going to ignore small and medium-sized businesses because the bigger the target, the bigger the impact, and the more the potential payout.
Yeah.
So they will be, you know, scouring the earnings reports of large companies. But then the way things have developed, they may not be able to go for some of the higher value targets because in the past few years, those targets in the private sector, think of the financial community, maybe manufacturing, have improved their cybersecurity. So they're harder to hack. And they also are better at backing up their data and restoring that. That's really the most interesting thing about these firms is how they operate. Ransomware is a service, and they have what they call affiliates, who are the hackers who actually break into the systems and then do the negotiating. So there can be like three different tiers, or even four different tiers, of individuals who are involved in this.
Vertically integrated to organized crime, basically.
Exactly. And in fact, they're so sophisticated that on the dark web, which is where these criminals operate, and you can't reach the dark web with a regular browser, you need a Tor browser, on their criminal forums online, these ransomware syndicates will advertise for specialists, software developers, offering some nice salaries. Of course, you might not be able to vacation outside of areas under Russian influence, but that's how it works.
And a lot of we really don't know exactly how big this problem is, because a lot of victims quietly pay the ransom, right?
Exactly. One thing that's interesting is if you look at this particular operation, the FBI director Ray said that they had shared, and let's describe a little bit what was done.
Yeah, how did they hack the hackers, so to speak?
Let's talk about how they hacked the hacker. The short answer is we don't know, but they had cooperation of German and Dutch agents, and that could be cyber police, and that could also be intelligence people, or the Dutch have been very successful in hacking organized crime online. The Dutch in particular have been key to taking down some online markets where drugs have been sold. But here's what the speculation is. Somehow the FBI or some aligned agency, US or foreign, got into this network, and whether they did it posing as an affiliate, we don't know. Whether they actually hacked into the system, because software being software, you can find vulnerabilities. Then they began distributing the decryption keys. And getting to your question about how much of the ransomware we don't know about, they say that they saved a potential $130 million in payments. They notified 1,300 victims while they were inside this network. 300 of those victims were in the midst of being attacked. Some had previously been attacked. But interestingly, only 20% of the victims had notified the FBI. So that gives you an indication. There you go. One in five ransomware victims don't disclose. And the problem that the Justice Department has had and the FBI Department have had all along is getting businesses that get hacked to own up to it and to notify them. Now, they could notify them quietly, and that's required for some critical infrastructure like pipelines now.
Why don't they? Why don't companies fess up?
Companies have things that they don't necessarily want the FBI rooting around in their networks. Maybe they have things they don't want law enforcement to know about. But the other thing is that when it becomes public, that you've been hacked, you have potential liability. You could face class action suits.
Stock will go down.
There's a class action suit right now that's actually a lawsuit in federal court in Southern District of Ohio, pending against a Memorial Healthcare, which operates two hospitals in Marietta and one across the river in West Virginia. And it was a victim of Hive. Uh-huh. And that was in August of 2021. And that caused, they had to halt non-elective surgeries. They had to turn some patients away and send them elsewhere. So that's a lawsuit that's seeking class action status. And there are as you can imagine, a number of suits like that that companies face, and not just companies, but also governments could face them as well.
So this sting operation affected 1,300 potential victims, 300 in the midst of being victimized. What is the expectation? What kind of impact is this going to have on this problem? Will it scare ransomware hackers away? Will they just change course? What is the expectation here?
Well, probably the best way to look at it, because these are business people, is that it raises the cost of business for them. So what the interesting thing about the operation is that they took down, at least temporarily disabled, this one ransomware network. But, you know, it's one of the top five ransom networks, and the affiliates who work in this, they might jump to another ransomware network. They're sort of free agents. But it increases their cost of doing business. And as law enforcement told us, they know who the administrators are. They have identified administrators and affiliates. So these people will be looking over their shoulder, presumably, and we can expect indictments. It could have some degree of a chilling effect on these criminals, although don't expect ransomware to be diminished at all as a problem.
Well, you mentioned the possibility of indictments, but you also said earlier that a lot of these folks are untouchable because they're outside the U.S. borders. Are there folks that they can actually bring to justice here in the United States, or are they going to be sort of indicted in absentia?
Well, there have been affiliates. A couple of Canadians have been arrested for working with ransomware gangs. So, yeah, there's not a lot of opportunity unless one of the people involved in these operations decides to vacation abroad, which happened to a major Russian criminal called Alexander Vinnik, who is now facing trial in California because he happened to decide to you know, pop over to Greece back in, I think it was 2017. With his family. And so he was running a major cryptocurrency exchange, which allegedly was laundering proceeds of ransomware, among other crimes. And which brings us to the cryptocurrency issue that we haven't mentioned, because cryptocurrency is how they pay.
Yeah. We're talking with Frank Byack. He's a reporter for the Associated Press on the status of the ransomware problem. FBI had a recent success in hacking the hackers and shutting down a major operation. Here on All Sides with Ann Fisher, Tech Tuesday. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. You mentioned the companies are getting better at preventing this. Security has tightened up. Is that the better long-term solution to this problem, is having better protections against these attacks?
Well, absolutely. And the other thing is, let's face it, there's a lot that companies can do, but it costs money. There's a lot that governments and school districts can do, but it costs money. And they don't necessarily have the money to do things like encrypt data at rest. So there's nothing that the criminals could exfiltrate and use to blackmail the victim. Yes, people are getting better. And one indication that people are getting better is that Chainalysis, which is a company that tracks cryptocurrency payments online, noted that actual proceeds from ransomware decreased from 2021 to 2022, what they could track, right?
By almost $300 million, it was a good amount of money.
A good chunk of change. I mean, and no one really knows what this criminal industry is worth, but it's certainly in the low billions a year at least. So the problem with this is that yes, fewer victims are paying ransoms because they're doing better at backing up. But so what happens is, the criminals start going for the lower hanging fruit. And that might just be a local government or a healthcare provider. I mean, 290 hospitals last year were affected in the US by this, 44 universities and colleges, 1,900 schools, because they have less money in the budget to institute the kind of protective measures that you need to, that you, to upgrade. You know, two-factor authentication is a simple thing that people can do to guard against hacking of their systems, because most hacking comes by phishing or by social engineering, by tricking people into clicking on those links, and boom, you're owned.
Yeah, that's my next question was, what can a smaller business or a smaller agency do to protect themselves? And two-factor verification is one. Anything else?
Two-factor authentication is one. Make sure you have good backups. Be careful about what you're storing. I mean, you can encrypt data on a separate segment of your network that is sensitive data. In the healthcare sector, we have HIPAA, where medical facilities are, you know, obliged by law to better protect our data. So if they're not doing that, they're going to be in trouble. But look, we live in an age now where we are so completely dependent on digital technology that people don't think twice about amassing huge amounts of sensitive data. Yeah. Look at T-Mobile. It's been hacked like 8 times since 2015. That's just an example of a company that should be doing better, but isn't. And why are we amassing all this data on, you know, systems that can be hacked? That's a question that we as a society need to ask ourselves, and we need to be more careful. When your business depends upon this sort of thing, as it does for Apple, for example, you're better than everyone else. So we need to up our game.
All right. Frank Bayak, reporter for the Associated Press, giving us an update on the ever-ending and probably never-ending battle against ransomware or whatever's next in the hacking world. Thanks for joining us on Tech Tuesday on All Sides.
Thanks, Mike.
We'll be back in just a moment. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It is Tech Tuesday, and ChatGPT has taken the internet by storm. 5 days after its release, it had garnered more than 1 million users. That was apparently enough to earn Microsoft's attention, which recently announced a multi-year, multi-billion dollar investment in Open Artificial Intelligence, the startup behind ChatGPT. Big tech has been taking a cautious approach to AI, but the instant success of tools like ChatGPT are forcing a change in strategy. That's according to our guest, Washington Post staff writer Will Oramus. Will, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks, Mike.
Great to have you here. Let's start with some basics here. ChatGPT, what is it? For those who have not been paying attention that closely.
ChatGPT is, in essence, a chatbot. It's a tool where you can write in some type of prompt and get a response. And that's not new. There have been chatbots since at least the 1960s. What's new is that ChatGPT can generate plausibly human-sounding responses on just about any topic in just about any style. So it's built on a type of AI known as large language models. And it is the latest iteration of this type of technology that has been mostly behind the scenes until recently.
So how would one use it?
Well, people are using ChatGPT in all sorts of ways. I mean, the first way is it can just be a toy. I mean, it can be fun to play around with, like try it out, talk to it. Right before I came on this show, I asked ChatGPT, about ChatGPT in the voice of a cynical tech reporter, and it says, yet another tech creation, the solution to all our problems, but let's get real. It's just a computer program fed with tons of text data spitting out generic answers. Be fooled by AI buzzwords. It's just a sophisticated search engine with limitations. something like that. So,
that what you just read was generated by artificial intelligence. Wasn't some cynical guy.
That was an out from ChatGPT pretending to be a cynical tech reporter talking about ChatGPT.
I'd say they nailed it. So that's how it works. How, aside from having fun, how might one use it?
Yeah, so people are finding ways to use it in their daily lives. We did a story a month or two ago on a guy who has a landscaping business. Literacy is a problem for him. He struggles with the written word. And so he always had a hard time communicating with his clients. He started using ChatGPT to sort of clean up his messages to clients, his interactions, and make them sound businesslike and professional. And he found that really useful. I read a story just the other day about real estate agents using ChatGPT to write the listings for houses. So you just tell it, you know, give me an enthusiastic real estate listing for a house with, you know, 2,500 square feet in Upper Arlington, you know, with granite countertops and whatever else, and it generates the whole listing. Now there are problems with using ChatGPT.
They don't know terms like cozy fixer upper. They don't know what a cozy fixer upper is, or.
It does know terms like cozy fixer-upper. Because the way it works is it's trained on just absolutely vast data sets of written language. So, you know, think of some of the largest websites in the world and everything that has ever been posted on them. They have fed all that text into this machine to find associations between words. In fact, if you type cozy, you know, fixer-upper would be the next thing on its artificial mind.
Not a bathrobe, just fixer-upper.
Maybe a bathrobe. That's right. Well, and see that gets to why there still has to be a human in charge. So ChatGPT can generate impressively plausible answers, but they're not always right answers. They're not always true. This AI is great at associations between words and ideas in the written language, but it doesn't actually know anything about the outside world in the way humans do. So it might just make stuff up. It might say stuff that, you know, that it found on some website, but that isn't applicable to the situation. So there always has to be a human reviewing what ChatGPT comes up with, or else you could get in big trouble.
We're talking about artificial intelligence, in particular ChatGPT, the latest in the artificial intelligence world, with Will Oramus, technology news analysis writer for The Washington Post. This scares a lot of people, Will. Journalists, are they going to be out of business? Are sort of entry-level copywriters at public relations firms, are they going to be out of business? Can companies just say, write me an obituary, but I don't need a person to write it, or write me basically a press release that we don't need a person to do that?
Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, I think any kind of writing that is formulaic can be either done by or at least potentially aided by a tool like ChatGPT. Again, with the caveat that it isn't always going to tell the truth. It isn't always going to get things right. And so if you don't have a human reviewing what it comes up with, you could be led into some serious errors. But yes, I think copywriting is a great example. I mean, now if let's say you're starting a new restaurant and you want to put up a website, but you don't have any expertise on you know, what a restaurant website should say, or what kind of language it should have, you could ask ChatGPT for help and it could give you ideas. Again, you'd still want to edit it. Another use that is scaring some people is that students in high school or college or middle school, you know, they have an essay prompt from their teacher, you know, talk about the importance of time in The Great Gatsby or something like that. They can ask ChatGPT and get, you know, probably a better response than your average middle schooler would give. Now, whether your teacher would know that it was artificially generated, that's a question. So people are trying to build some of the tools that can detect artificially generated text versus human written text.
Now, how do you get access to this? Can anyone get access to it? Do you have to pay a subscription? What's the work?
Well, for OpenAI's tool, ChatGPT, anybody can sign up right now. Sometimes there's a wait list. Increasingly, recently, due to its popularity, it's often over capacity. And so you'll try to open up ChatGPT in your browser window, and it'll say, sorry, not available right now. Sometimes it'll say that, like, in the voice of a pirate. They kind of play around with their messages using ChatGPT. But They're testing ways to make a paid service. We do not know yet whether they're going to make everybody pay or whether they're going to leave up a free version. I suspect that at least for the time being, it will remain free. But if you use the free version, you got to put up with the wait times and with sometimes not being able to get in. If you pay up, and at least one test suggested it might be $42 a month, then you could kind of skip the line and use it even when it's over capacity for the free users.
So there's the money. And now big tech companies are trying to jump on board. What's going on with the industry and how do big companies see the future of this?
Yeah, I mean, the money for big companies might actually be a little different. So Microsoft was an early investor in OpenAI, the startup behind ChatGPT. It invested $1 billion early on, mostly giving OpenAI the computing power, the server power to train its data sets. It takes a lot of computing power. And it's very expensive to do that. More recently, Microsoft made a much bigger, as you said, multi-billion, multi-year investment in OpenAI. And it's beginning to integrate these AI tools into its own products. And it's also beginning to offer them as a service to other businesses. So one of the core of Microsoft's business these days, I mean, you might think of Microsoft Office, you know, Word, Excel, Outlook. Actually, their biggest moneymaker is selling cloud services and professional services to other businesses. It is now packaging some of these AI tools and saying, hey, we'll teach your business how to build around these, how to make a chatbot of your own for your purposes, how to use image generation. We haven't talked about that yet, but ChatGPT is an AI that turns text, you know, responds to text with other text. There are also tools from OpenAI and other AI startups that can turn text into an image, and they can, you know, sort of create art for any prompt you might have. So, you know, Microsoft is hoping to profit from this really on the enterprise side. They're also doing it on the consumer side, though. For instance, you'll see in Microsoft Excel, if you make a spreadsheet, there's now a tool that says analyze spreadsheet, and it uses similar AI technology to write up a little analysis of some of the key findings in your spreadsheet.
Wow. We're using this technology now. We have been. Like, you type in the word skunk into your text message on your phone, a little picture of a skunk comes up, right? Is it the same basic principle?
I don't know if I'd use that specific example, but yes, you're absolutely right that there are versions of this technology that are already in widespread use. I think the one that I often turn to is autocomplete.
Yeah, typing an email.
If you're using Gmail, I mean, it predicts what the rest of the sentence will be, and you can just accept it if you think that it basically got it right. Think of ChatGPT as autocomplete on steroids. I mean, it doesn't even need the first half of the sentence. It can just guess the whole thing. The difference being that, you know, Google in Gmail, autocomplete is only going to show up if it has a pretty good guess of what you're going to say. Whereas ChatGPT, it'll just take a stab at it no matter what.
That could be dangerous. Autocomplete's dangerous now. Imagine having a whole email done for you. That would be dangerous. Be careful there.
Well, and that's why some of these big tech companies have moved slowly. I mean, that's one of the reasons, is that these tools can be dangerous. You know, you can imagine using AI to spin up a whole fake news website or to spit out propaganda on social media to advance a certain cause. You know, because it's trained on data from across the web, it ingests the biases of the humans who use the web, right? So it'll sometimes spit out stuff that's misogynist or racist or discriminatory towards people of a certain religion. So the big tech companies have been treading cautiously here, but then along comes a startup like OpenAI making this stuff available to the public, and all of a sudden they feel the pressure to respond by maybe releasing some of their own tools that they've kept under wraps until now.
You look at media sites, BuzzFeed apparently is an adopter, but you look at what BuzzFeed publishes, it's very formulaic, a lot of lists, top 15 this, top 25 this. So that's the kind of publication that could benefit from this, correct?
Yeah, and to distinguish, I mean, BuzzFeed has a news division that does like serious human journalism, including investigative stuff. But yeah, a lot of what BuzzFeed does is making listicles like that. Like, you know, if you're in your early 30s and grew up in Virginia, you'll remember these 15 things from your childhood, right? Like, that could easily be done by AI instead of a human. So there are all these different use cases of sort of like, for lack of a better term, low quality content around the web that could easily be automated. You asked earlier about replacing journalism. Maybe I'm flattering us here as journalists, but I think, you know, that's a lot harder because you need to understand the context for a news development. You need to be able to go out and find new information, whereas the AI is really about regurgitating information that's already out there. You need to be able to ask hard questions, and the AI doesn't necessarily know what questions to ask. So I think we're a long way from replacing journalism entirely, but already it's being used as part of journalism. There's a very popular tech site called CNET that does reviews of products and such. And it turned out that it had been using AI to help generate some of its reviews and also to augment some of its reviews and update them. So Google search engine likes to put things in the top search results that have been recently published. So it turned out CNET was using AI to go through and like add a little bit of boilerplate text to old reviews and then republish them so that they would show up in Google search results as brand new.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's the concern is, you know, robots just taking over. Is this one small step in that progression? And you still need, I mean, I could see how you could use maybe take a court transcript. We have a big trial here happening in Ohio, former House speakers on trial at federal court. Could ChatGPT take the transcript of today's testimony and turn it into an article?
Absolutely. Yeah. And just be careful how much faith you put in the accuracy of that article. But certainly it's summarizing text is one of its real strong suits. You could even, you know, if you there's a 2-hour long YouTube video and you just want to know the gist of it, you can use a tool that has a transcript of the video, plug that into something like ChatGPT, and it'll give you, you know, a 1,000-word summary or really however long you want the summary to be.
What's next after this? An AI.
That's a great question. I mean, it can feel like sentient AI is just around the corner. I mean, there was even my colleague Natasha Tiku at the Post did a story last year about a Google engineer who worked on Google's chatbot called Lambda, who became convinced that it was in fact sentient. I mean, he really felt that this was an entity with a mind of its own, deserving of its own rights. Now that was, you know, Google, I think, fired him over that. I don't know all the details. They didn't appreciate that. But that is one of the risks, is that as humans, when we see something talking like a human, we tend to attribute all the other human faculties to it as well. In fact, again, you know, if you think of it as autocomplete on steroids, this is very far from human intelligence, but there is that risk of people coming to view it as a human. I think particularly kids, you know, if kids play with an AI like this, they might come to trust it or to view it as an authority figure or something that knows everything. And there you could have a risk of real harm.
How does a teacher spot a term paper done with this?
There are lots of people trying to figure that out right now. There are people developing tools that they say can detect whether a given essay was generated by AI or not. Just as there are tools, you know, for years there have been tools out there to detect plagiarism. And like the plagiarism detection tools, I mean, they're going to get it right sometimes. They're going to get it wrong sometimes. There are, and teachers are having to learn on their own, like what are the signs of possibly an AI-written article or an AI-written essay versus an essay that's written by a kid.
Will Oramus, technology news analysis writer for The Washington Post, talking about artificial intelligence and ChatGPT. It's exciting times, but also a little unnerving as to what lies ahead with artificial intelligence. Will, thanks for joining us here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides.
Enjoy the conversation.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, Tech Tuesday. I'm Mike Thompson on 89.7 NPR News. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The U.S. Justice Department and 8 states last week filed a lawsuit against Google over its digital advertising business, claiming the tech giant constitutes an illegal monopoly. It's the second antitrust suit federal authorities have brought against the company's advertising empire, which has for years been under scrutiny over allegations of self-dealing and choking off competitors. Patience Hagen covers digital advertising for The Wall Street Journal, and she's been following this story and joins us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Patience, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Just how Google is the advertising behemoth? How much of a behemoth is it? Let's start there.
Google is by far the market leader in digital advertising, both the US and globally. It's the largest company taking the lion's share of the ad spending. It's a really interesting question because there's actually several different parts of the digital ad food chain. Google is strong in all of them, but the Justice Department is looking specifically at the areas where it argues they have the most dominance and kind of the closest thing to a monopoly. That's especially Google's ad server, which is software that helps publishers put their ad slots online. It's used by 90% of large publishers. That's 90% market share. That's enormous. So the Justice Department is also really interested in Google's ad exchange, where buyers and sellers, you know, actually transact and buy the ads. On that piece of technology, they say Google has more than 50% market share.
Wow. The ad server. So how does that work? You're a company, you want to advertise in, say, the Columbus Dispatch or WOSU. You have to go through Google to get your ad placed. How does that work?
You go to an ad buying software. Google has one of those too, DV360. It's also the market leader in its category. But that's actually a slightly more competitive part of the market. The ad exchange and the ad server are the ones where Google's dominated. They've taken more than half the market. And that's the part the Justice Department is focusing on in its suit. It's really fascinating because there's so many different ways they could have come at it. And they chose to focus on this kind of the publisher end of the pipeline where they basically believe they can make the strongest case.
And so who gets the revenue you'd think that if the ad shows up on a local publisher's website that they're getting the revenue? How much of that revenue are they getting? How much is Google getting?
Well, Google gets at least 30 cents of every dollar, according to the lawsuit. That's huge. I mean, that's huge for just the middleman. That's, you know, the publisher's getting, you know, 70% or less, depending on what other vendors might be involved.
Yeah, and if you have 90% of the market, just if you do the math, that's a lot of money. And that's where newspapers and publishers have complained that they have to go through Google and or Google is stealing their ad revenue. And that's why they're hurting.
That's a huge part of why the suit is being brought. You know, there's a lot of different industries where some companies are very powerful. But if you look at digital advertising, you know, that's an industry that props up so much of the media online. And now governments are taking a really serious look at, you know, should we rein in that industry a little bit more? If we do so, is it going to help a thriving, is it going to do more to support a thriving news sector?
Yeah. Let's get into the nitty gritty of this case. The Justice Department has alleged that Google has abused this market, its market power in online ads. What specifically does it use as evidence? How does it back that up?
Right. They allege several different ways that Google was, you know, behind the scenes using its size to elbow out competition. For instance, there was this rival online bidding technology called header bidding that some of Google's rival ad exchanges with smaller market share were starting to use. According to this complaint, you know, the government makes the pretty explosive allegation that Google tweaked parts of its ad buying software to make sure that if you were using a rival exchange that used header bidding, your bids would be lower. So you would be losing more of those auctions, and that would essentially kind of deter people away from those rival exchanges and make it harder for their rivals to survive.
Wow. I mean, that's certainly manipulating the market.
Right, absolutely. And the Justice Department argues that those kinds of tactics, which Google was able to engage in because of its size and its presence in every step of the food chain, they argue that those tactics essentially hurt both advertisers and publishers. That it kept ad prices artificially high, hurting the buyers, and that it contributed to added costs for publishers, so it ate into their revenue.
Do you have any idea how much money they reaped from that? Do they put a figure in the indictment?
I don't know if they put a figure like specifically from those kind of schemes.
Yeah.
In terms of the size of their ad business, you know, they reported $31 billion in revenue back in 2021. That's just from like ad brokering activity. That's just from the ad exchange and ad server, the parts that the Justice Department is suing over. That doesn't even include the other parts of their ad business.
Uh-huh. How does Google respond to this?
Well, Google says that the Justice Department is essentially trying to meddle inappropriately in the market, and they're saying that'll hurt the industry. They said this is going to slow innovation if the Justice Department gets what it wants and gets them to sell off that part of the business. It's going to slow down innovation. It's going to weaken Google's position as a leader in innovating new technologies for the ad market. They argue that it's going to raise advertising fees and make things more expensive. They argue that the department's essentially trying to pick winners and losers in this market.
It must hurt their case if they have 90% of a market, that they are the winner. I mean, if you have 9 out of 10 customers for your sector of the economy, it's going to be hard to defend that, no?
Absolutely. It does look hard to defend, especially that ad server piece that has 90% market share. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of experts are looking at this, and they predict that Google's going to settle by agreeing to sell off at least that part, if not more parts of the ad business.
We're talking about monopolies and big tech with Wall Street Journal reporter Patience Hagen. She covers digital advertising for the Wall Street Journal. In particular, we're talking about the lawsuit the Justice Department has filed against Google. The Justice Department filed a lawsuit against Google over its digital advertising business, claiming the tech giant constitutes an illegal monopoly. Patience, in 2008, the Federal Trade Commission declined to block Google's acquisition of digital ad broker DoubleClick, saying at the time that Google is not a threat to competition in digital advertising. Now, the Justice Department says the deal was Google's first step towards a monopoly. What's changed?
Well, I think it's a fascinating question. They're literally, you know, they're basically saying the government made a mistake before. I think it's just what's changed is the way that large companies have really taken over. Like these large Silicon Valley companies, they were exciting and new back in 2008. No one was afraid. No one could have predicted how powerful they'd become. I mean, now they've become powerful, and they're seeping into every aspect of our lives and society. Washington is now feeling the need to rein them in. Washington is looking back over the decisions it made in previous decades and looking at how it got this way.
Yeah, a lot of calls from lawmakers, Elizabeth Warren being a chief and Bernie Sanders being a chief advocate, saying that big tech needs to be broken up. Also, conservatives also claiming that censorship on part of the social media platforms should require Facebook and other social media platforms to be broken up. Is this the first step? I mean, we go back 120 years to the big trust busters in the early 1900s. Is this the first step in trust busting and breaking up monopolies in big tech? Is that the feeling out there in the industry?
I mean, it certainly could be. It's a huge kind of monumental sign for our regulators' seriousness about reining in Silicon Valley. If you look at some of the previous examples, times when competition regulators have looked closely at tech companies like Bell Labs or Microsoft, you know, in all those cases, it really did a lot to change the market. Like the breakup of Bell Labs completely changed the tech market at that time. The antitrust investigation of Microsoft, it changed the direction of the company a lot. It kept them, you know, it kept them from innovating for several years. They weren't able to, you know, they weren't able to explore new business lines or make large acquisitions for a while. So I'm sure it'll be a monumental piece in the history of technology.
Has anyone studied that particular case there, the Microsoft antitrust and the lack of innovation that Microsoft perhaps was prevented from doing? Did it allow other firms to get in there and innovate because Microsoft did not have the same market share? Has there anyone done any research on that and whether or not in the long run that did benefit the industry and benefit us as consumers?
Great point. And several people have a lot of scholars and people have written books about the Microsoft suit. They say that that's what contributed to Google's growth. Exactly. Microsoft, it kept Microsoft from being on the cutting edge of things like search or mobile phones. And it really paved the way for Google itself to rise. You know, it's interesting how it's just kind of a never-ending cycle. Like, there's always going to be a giant that gets too big, and then, you know, someone else disrupts it. Eventually, the disruptor gets so big that someone comes to disrupt them.
And it's just moved so fast now. But these, I mean, you know, Google is still a relatively young company when you think about it. And Twitter and Facebook even younger. But these companies have a lot of political power. Silicon Valley has a lot of money, and donors give to politicians. How hard is it going to be to break up these companies, should they need to be broken up?
That's a fascinating question, and I can't wait to see what's going to happen. This suit wasn't easy. It's been years in the making. The Justice Department's gone through a lot to bring it. They've had to wait for the right political moment to bring it. What we're seeing is, you know, we're predicting that it'll end in some kind of settlement where Google voluntarily agrees to get rid of some pieces, and that's going to say a lot about kind of the position these companies are in and what they're finding they need to do in order to appease the regulators.
Is a settlement, it depends on the nature of the settlement and what each side agrees to, but is the settlement the best thing for the overall situation here? Because Google's going to settle for something that's more advantageous to them than if they had gone to trial.
That's a fascinating question. You'd have to ask the Justice Department, yeah, what's the best thing. And yeah, you could ask Google what's the best thing too, and they'd say different things. It's just going to be fascinating to watch it unfold. Like, and people are already debating over what's going to be the effect on the market if it happens. If they sell it off, like, does some other big company buy that, or does it just become an independent? Do they just spin it off as an independent company? Once it's an independent company, is it going to retain the kind of dominance that it has, or, you know, once it's no longer attached to Google, is that edge going to fade a little bit? Yeah. So it'll be fascinating to see what becomes of the landscape if it becomes more competitive.
Yeah, we saw that with the phone companies. They broke into several different companies, and you could argue that perhaps we all benefited from that, especially if you look back over the mobile phone expansion, but still relatively few companies there. I take it Amazon is watching this one pretty closely.
They absolutely are. Amazon has been hearing from regulators too. It's interesting because they've been talked about as a potential company that might want to buy, you know, it might make sense for them to buy this ad tech company that if Google is putting it up for sale to appease the regulators. But it's difficult to imagine that they could do that without needing to get antitrust clearance. And, you know, are the regulators going to say the same thing that they said about Google? Like, it's hard to imagine them being able to buy it without running into the same antitrust concerns.
Meta, Facebook's owner, has to be watching this as well, because they control a lot of the social media advertising and social media marketplace.
Absolutely, them too. Just about every company that could afford it is so big are they going to run into the same antitrust concerns? Every company that can afford it is already so big in digital advertising that how would the regulators let them get away with it?
Are there companies we haven't heard of that are also the Justice Department has its eye on? The average person, not the tech writer person, but the average person out there?
Oh, I'm sure they do. I just can't wait to see who it'll be.
So what's the timeline on this? You said it's been a long time going to get to this point. How long is this going to take? 3 years, 5 years?
Now that's like the $1 million question. I think it's definitely going to be several years. They've been working on this since at least 2019. So it's taken like, you know, 3+ years just to file the suit. And then how long is the investigation going to be? Is Google going to settle it sooner rather than later? We'll see.
Yeah. Anyway, it's going to be something to watch. It's going to have broad implications on really all of our lives. We all use Google. We always see these ads. It affects many components of the tech industry and things that we use every day. And Could be the breakup of big tech, the first step? We don't know. Thanks very much, Patience Hagen from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.